This is PCJ Radio International.
Hello and welcome to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. I'm Keith Perron. Well, everybody's talking about the Olympics. That's right, the Sochi 2014 Olympics that are taking place in Russia. But Russia has been in the news lately, especially over the past year, over a wide variety of issues. First, the anti-gay law, as it's called, human rights, and journalists being attacked and even expelled from the country. Now, a lot of people are saying this is sort of like reminiscences of the Cold War. Well, it is true that Russia has changed, some people would say, for the worst over the last few years. But what about the coverage of Sochi? What is being reported in the media in Russia and what is being left out? And what is it like working as a foreign correspondent in Russia under the new media restrictions? We have this special report from Richard Ady.
As we count down to Sochi, it's time to get excited and get behind our athletes.
Russia's Olympic city has been rehearsing its fireworks display.
It also alleges contracts for the most expensive facilities were given to companies close to President Vladimir Putin.
As hordes of journalists arrive to cover the games, many discover their accommodations are not yet ready.
First of all, don't worry about the snow. Snow will be guaranteed.
Guaranteed?
Yeah.
Actually, you're not about to hear a great deal about the Winter Olympics. There'll be plenty on that over the next couple of weeks. Instead, we're going to look at journalism in Russia, one of the most difficult countries in the world to be a reporter or editor. It's no longer a communist totalitarian state, but it's still incredibly secretive. There's no real freedom of speech or freedom of the press. And it's dangerous. 18 journalists have been murdered in the last 10 years, overwhelmingly while they were covering corruption, crime, politics and business, which in Russia are all intertwined. So where to start? Well, the obvious place, Sochi. The Committee to Protect Journalists has recently put out a report on the journalism covering the build-up to the Games. Its author is Nina Ognianova.
There's a lot to talk about when it comes to Sochi and the preparation for the Olympics that unfortunately has become concealed for the Russian media and therefore for the Russian public. The exploitation of migrant workers is one of the abuses that has stained preparation for the Olympics, along with corruption, damage to the environment, eviction of local Sochi residents whose homes have come to be on the path of Olympic construction, adoption of a series of laws that restrict freedom of the press and freedom of expression and run contrary to the Russian constitution, a slew of sensitive issues such as high-level corruption in the business sector, the bankruptcy of local business in the process of the Olympic preparation, and the overall just inconvenience, day-to-day inconvenience for local residents who have come to experience things like long-lasting power outages, water shortage, colossal traffic jams, and so on and so forth.
That is a long list. But I'm wondering if those sorts of issues are usually covered by the Russian media, like outside of covering the build-up to the Olympics, or does Sochi present a neat example of everything that the media in Russia is struggling with?
Well, you know, Russia has never been a shining example of freedom of expression and press freedom. But in the run-up to the Sochi Olympics, the extent of the censorship and the extent of the pressure on all independent voices has reached a new high. Whereas some of these issues have been covered by regional media, by definitely some of the mainstream print media in Russia before, you know, issues like human rights abuses, corruption, and so on and so forth. Now we are seeing a sort of total blackout for information that's negative and that comes out of the Olympic city, to the extent that Russian media cover the games the way that they would cover a deceased person, in positive light or not at all.
When you went through that list, so mistreatment of migrant workers, corruption, environmental damage, eviction of locals without adequate compensation, those are terrific, meaty stories. If you're a journalist in a place like Sochi, which I think is about 350,000 people, it's not huge, but it will have a local journalism community, you should know about those things and be dying to tell your readers and viewers and listeners about them.
Well, everyone knows about these issues. They're not a secret for the journalists or for the local residents. It's just that most of the media locally are either owned or completely dependent on the municipal budget. So they're financed by the local government. They depend on the state for their advertisement revenue. And their livelihood, their staying on the air or staying in print, depends on whether they get those state subsidies. That means that they do toe the line that the local government and the federal government, by extension, is formulating for them and is formatting for them as framework of coverage.
What about what amounts to the national media in Russia? Can't they go after these stories?
Well, you know, the national television stations are all either state-owned or state-controlled, and the majority of the population in Russia is getting their stories and their news from the national broadcasters. They are not covering the Olympics in a negative light, period. When it comes to the mainstream media that are privately owned, many of them are still owned by Kremlin-friendly figures, oligarchs, business people. And so there is an internal kind of directive not to anger the authorities, not to spoil the image of Russia in the run-up to this mega event, which should make everyone proud. There was one newspaper, Kommersant, which translates to business person, and it's the biggest and most influential business daily in Russia. Mm-hmm. It's a very professional newspaper. It usually does cover the kind of front page stories that the New York Times would cover or any big newspaper in the world would cover. But when it comes to the Olympic story, they too have been gagged. In one specific case, a prominent journalist was tasked to cover the eviction of Sochi residents because of Olympic construction. She did a terrific series on that subject. And even though her editor and her newsroom were pressured to check the story, the editor decided not to bow to the pressure and went ahead with the story and published the series. Very shortly after that, he was fired on a different pretext. But his colleagues say that he was fired because of not bowing down to pressure when it comes to covering the Olympics. And that prominent correspondent who bylined the stories was then taken off the Sochi story.
Nina Ognianova from the Committee to Protect Journalists. More from her later. To understand the latest version of Russia's repressive media climate, you have to go back a couple of years to the end of 2011, after the parliamentary elections, but before the presidential poll that would return Vladimir Putin to the Kremlin. There were huge public protests, and Norman Hammond had a ringside seat as the ABC's Moscow correspondent.
Some of it, if you can recall, was almost unprecedented. I mean, these rallies were so large in scope, people hadn't seen anything like this in the Putin era, certainly, that state television and networks that are generally sympathetic to the Kremlin had no choice to report these rallies. I mean, normally these sorts of protests are given very little coverage, but they were so large that they would have been laughingstocks had they not reported on them. So they actually had to report on the rallies, and it was quite extraordinary seeing not only the big Russian networks, the state networks, but even networks like NTV, which is nominally an independent network, reporting on these rallies and what was happening not only in Moscow but in big cities across the country. So there was this really brief moment where it looked like the media was liberalizing incredibly quickly. And people were thinking back to the heady days of sort of the mid-1990s, when there was this brief period of extremely free media, especially in the mass media, the broadcast media in Russia. And then, of course, as the protest movement started to wane, that changed very quickly.
So once he was elected again, what happened?
Well, that was in May 2012. Mm. And then during the summer, typically what happens is most Russian cities, particularly Moscow, sort of shut down for the summer. The people involved, as funny as it may sound, these people are running a protest movement for the very future of the country, but many of them took extended vacations through that summer and were out of the country. And it lost a lot of momentum. And while that was happening, the media crackdown sort of took place. A lot of that coverage we had been seeing in the mainstream broadcast media sort of disappeared. And there were a number of essentially hit jobs done by either public networks or Kremlin-friendly networks on protest leaders, documentaries about how they had accepted money, all aimed at discrediting the leaders of the protest. And it was a very, for people who remembered Soviet times, there was a real air of familiarity to it, because it did look like a Kremlin-orchestrated campaign in the mass media to try and discredit the opposition. And to a large extent, it really was successful, because outside of Moscow, many people just started to consider people involved with the opposition, the leadership, as no better than the people in the Kremlin, and just somehow trying to get power through another means. So that consistent drumbeat of coverage did seem to sort of wear down the leadership of the opposition.
But reporting critically has become harder too. There's now defamation's now criminal again. You've got things like websites that are blacklisted for carrying unlawful content, which can be interpreted almost however it suits anyone in authority to interpret it. Treason's now been defined so vaguely that it could be that any information shared with an international journalist is an act of espionage.
I think the key, Richard, is it doesn't even have to get that far. If you look at what's happening right now to Dosht TV, Rain Television, which was probably the most independent network in Russia, it was on... It's a small operation that is primarily internet-based and then is carried on cable networks and satellite networks across Russia, and developed a very large following during these protests. And without any of these draconian measures that you're speaking of, they've managed to essentially silence it by putting huge amounts of pressure on cable operators to simply drop the channel. And that's exactly what's happened. So it's now been left to an internet stream. Now, an internet stream in Russia is very good for people who want to see it in Moscow and a few other big cities. But the vast majority of Russians still get their news and information from broadcast media.
Mm-hmm.
And broadcast media is really the key. So once you remove an opposition or an independent voice from broadcast media, it essentially has been removed from the national debate. And that's exactly what they've been moving to do.
So while you were there doing your own reporting, of course, you were seeing what was happening to Russian journalists reporting for Russian outlets. In the teeth of these law changes and heavy pressure, how did they respond?
Well, sadly, a number of journalists simply complied. Others continue to fight on, but you know, it's a very complicated picture. For instance, one of the most well-known independent liberal democratic voices in Russia is Echo Radio in Moscow, which is a radio station and has a cable TV network as well that's mostly seen by people over the internet. And it has always operated freely. It continues to ask tough questions of the Kremlin, but there's always been this allegation that it is sort of permitted to operate as an outlet for liberal democratic thought, that it's a way for the Kremlin to be able to point to Westerners and to critics and say, we do allow this kind of discussion. Because when you go outside of Moscow to the rest of Russia, you know, these kind of networks have almost no influence. Virtually, they're not part of the popular conversation. No one is really thinking about them, talking about them. So there are networks like that that exist in isolation. There's other examples of things that happened. For instance, when we were in Russia and we did some reporting on this, there was a media personality. Her name is Ksenia Sobchak, and she comes from a very well-connected family within the Kremlin. And she very sensationally adopted the protests as one of her cause. And she was doing a lot of work on popular television. She wasn't a serious news person, but she would have, you know, was very well-known personality on things like what we have in Australia. You know, Australia's Got Talent, being a judge. She was everywhere in the magazines. And within 2 months, she had nothing. She was not on the airwaves anywhere, except for Dosht TV, Rain TV, where she had a show. But essentially, she talked to us very frankly about her career had essentially been reduced to one gig in a matter of months. And it was all due to pressure put on broadcasters from the Kremlin to make these people disappear from the public view, people who supported sort of the protest movement.
Norman Hammond. It's easy to see why the mainstream media hasn't distinguished itself covering Sochi. But according to Nina Ognianova, this has left space for smaller, independent journalists.
That is a phenomenon that has emerged out of the mainstream media silence on Sochi. The local activists, we're talking about environmental activists, rights defenders, even lawyers who defend migrant workers who have been robbed of their salaries or who have been defending evicted residents. This community of brave individuals have taken on the task that usually falls upon journalists. They have been doing that via social networks, in blogging platforms, on YouTube, and they have been doing that at a great risk for themselves and their own livelihood, as well as for the livelihood of their families. When we did our report, we spoke with many of these activists, and they shared with us their personal stories of harassment, intimidation, bureaucratic raids that they have experienced because they have refused to keep their mouths shut about the evictions, about the corruption, about the environmental damage, and all of the other issues that we just talked about.
Nina Ognianova from the Committee to Protect Journalists.
Russia is one of the most dangerous countries in the world for journalists.
A Russian newspaper reporter died earlier this month when he fell out of an apartment block window.
The very first cup of tea completely incapacitated me. I lost consciousness practically straight away.
Anna Politkovskaya was shot dead outside her Moscow apartment. The 48-year-old won praise and made high-powered enemies with her reporting on Russia's war in Chechnya and for her criticism of the Putin presidency.
His old desk is now a memorial and the story has been shelved.
We want the real murderers to be found.
And now most of the journalists don't speak up what they think.
Ivan Safronov's death made the pages of his newspaper, but few other Russian media bothered to report it.
If you're a Russian journalist, asking too many questions can get you killed. It's different if you're an American foreign correspondent. The worst thing that can happen is being expelled. Though that hasn't occurred since the days of the Cold War. Until last Christmas, that is, when David Satter, a veteran of three stints in Moscow, was kicked out. But it's not only what was done, it's the way it was done. In a very carefully worded statement, he was told that competent organs had determined his presence was undesirable.
The last time an American correspondent was expelled was 1982, when Andrew Nagorsky of Newsweek was expelled. But I've been covering Russia, covering the Soviet Union, actually, for almost four decades. And during that time, I don't know of a single case in which this kind of phrasing was used to justify the expulsion of a correspondent. This is the kind of phraseology that's used when you're talking about espionage. So it was very unusual.
So why did it happen, David?
Well, of course, only the FSB and only the Russian authorities know for sure. I can only guess. In the 3 months that I was in Russia, I simply did not have time to do anything that was that significant. Most of those 3 months were spent setting up an apartment, opening a bank account, taking care of various bureaucratic details. I wrote a couple of articles, but it would certainly not have been enough in and of itself to justify an expulsion. I think it was their assessment of what I've done in the past and what they thought I was capable of doing in the future.
Yes.
That's my best guess.
If their concern was what you'd done in the past, they had a fair bit to choose from, didn't they? But I'm wondering if, in particular, it was the very pointed questions that you've asked about the apartment bombings of 1999, which turned out to be important in the rise of Putin eventually to the presidency, that might have been the key problem.
It's very possible, because the apartment bombings were discussed in my book, Darkness at Dawn, which came out in 2003. The Russian authorities reacted, in my case, by pretending that what I said didn't exist. But in the case of other people, Russians, who raised the same issues, they dealt with them in a much different way. For example, Alexander Litvinenko was poisoned with a radioactive isotope in London. Yuri Shekhachihin, a Russian journalist, was poisoned. Sergei Yushchenkov, another person who raised this issue, was shot and killed. So this is obviously a very sensitive question.
Well, that's it. And perhaps I should get you to explain why, because we're talking about hundreds of people being killed at these bombings. I think the Chechens...
300. Yes, 300.
The Chechens were blamed, but there are at least questions about whether the FSB, so state security, which was then headed by Putin, or he'd perhaps just left there, might not have been responsible themselves.
Well, absolutely. There were four bombings in three cities, two in Moscow, one in Buinaksk, which is in Dagestan, and one in the city of Volgodonsk. And then a fifth bomb was discovered in the basement of an apartment building in Ryazan. It's a city southeast of Moscow. And the local police acted quickly. And the persons who put the bomb in the basement were caught. But to the surprise of everyone, they didn't turn out to be Chechens. They turned out to be agents of the FSB. Now, how do you explain that?
Training exercise, I believe, is what was said at the time.
It was said at the time, but it certainly didn't resemble a training exercise when it took place, and a training exercise can't be conducted with a live bomb. And the bomb was tested, and it tested positive for hexagon, the same explosive that was used in the other bombings.
David, one of the things that occurs to me as you tell this story is that you mentioned the other journalist who asked the hard questions. Three of them are dead. They were Russian. You're alive. You're American. Do you think that's why you are alive?
Very well, that's undoubtedly one of the reasons. We've seen that Russian journalists, Russian investigators, Russian writers are very vulnerable, much more vulnerable than representatives of Western media.
How would you assess their vulnerability if you think, I think something like 18 Russian journalists have been killed in the last 10 years. Are Russian journalists safer now than they were, say, 10 years ago when Putin had fairly recently risen to the top?
No, not at all, because there have been recent cases of either journalists or human rights activists being murdered. For example, Mikhail Beketov in the Khimki region, who wrote about corruption surrounding the construction of a road, projected construction of a road connecting Moscow and Leningrad through the Khimki forest, was savagely beaten and left an invalid and died ultimately from his injuries. And Natalia Estemerova in Grozny was taken out. She was not a journalist herself, but she collected information about human rights abuses and made that information available to journalists. She was kidnapped from her office in Grozny in Chechnya and taken out and murdered and assassinated. So no, it's not stopping. I mean, on the contrary, journalists are just as defenseless and vulnerable now as they were in the past.
All right. But what about the foreign correspondents? Are they now working in a more hostile climate?
Well, I don't think it is hostile in the direct sense, because the Russian authorities try to manipulate and influence the foreign press. And the foreign reporters in Moscow, even those who speak Russian, and many of them do now, oftentimes are at a disadvantage when it comes to penetrating Russian society. They obviously have a tough time knowing Russia as well and in as much depth as Russian reporters do. So what the authorities try to do is to kind of influence them, give them privileged access in return for cooperation, avoiding controversial subjects. Some are invited to the Valdai Discussion Club, so-called, at which they can meet high-level Russian officials who in effect propagandize them. It's a struggle for most foreign reporters really to penetrate the surface of the society.
Which might be why David Satter has his problem, because he's better able than most to do exactly that. Of course, not all foreign correspondents are invited in for drinks and propaganda. Nina Ognianova says one or two have been seriously harassed.
The case with a Norwegian two-person crew for TV2, which is the official Olympic broadcaster for Norway.
Mm. They were detained and threatened, weren't they, those two?
That's right. So Øystein Bogen, a reporter, and his cameraman were traveling in southern Russia through the Republic of Adygea on the way to Sochi to interview local sources about the impact of the Olympics on their lives when in a period of 48 hours they were stopped six times and they were detained three times. During this very unpleasant ordeal, local police intimidated them, threatened to jail them, at some point refused to allow them to call their embassy. Even in one drastic episode, a local policeman tried to force the reporter Bogan to take a drug test. He refused to do so, but the stress and the level of obstruction, I have to say, was unprecedented for an international crew.
That was Nina Ognavania speaking to Richard Aidy. And with that, we've come to the end of this special edition of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. If you want to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is very simple, mnp@pcjmedia.com. That's mnp@pcjmedia.com. I also want to remind you that you can listen to this program through Stitcher Smart Radio and through a wide variety of partner stations around the world. So until next time, friends, I'm Keith Powell wishing you well, saying so long and take care, 73 and 88 to the ladies.